I'd like now to welcome to the program Christopher Bohm. He's the director of the Jane Goodall Research Center and professor of biological sciences and anthropology at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. And he's author of the new book, Moral Origins, The Evolution of Virtue, Altruism, and Shame. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you very much.
So the problem of explaining these qualities, virtue, altruism, shame, from an evolutionary perspective, before there was an evolutionary perspective, as I understand, there was pretty much a God perspective, a religious perspective on things like altruism. Why is altruism a problem in terms of evolutionary science?
Well, it's such a problem that it's preoccupied literally thousands of scholars since 1975, when Edward O. Wilson first got us all interested in this. The problem is that evolution is a theory which says that everyone is trying to maximize his or her own reproductive success. And if we're all hell-bent on reproducing as much as possible and gaining every advantage we can, then where is the room in this system for someone to basically do something nice for somebody else? Basically, you're giving away your own product to someone else, and therefore your competitive position is lowered and theirs is raised relative to you. And the genes that make people altruistic should simply go away in a hurry.
And at the same time, on an intuitive level to a layman like me, it seems fairly clear that there would be altruism just because nobody can survive as an individual. There's no such thing, at least in species like ours, or in most species, I take it, as individual survival. You need groups of beings and, in fact, ecosystems in order to survive at all.
Well, yes. Humans are a cooperative species. And that is where we get the sort of big intellectual puzzle about altruism. How can we cooperate if, as individuals, we're more or less doomed by the nature of natural selection to be selfish? There's still another way of looking at this, and that is just through common sense. Take a look around you and see whether people are truly selfish or not. And the common sense answer is no. I mean, people give blood anonymously at blood banks all the time. Of course, sometimes they give buildings to universities and want their name pasted all over the building, in which case we will not count that as altruistic because they're getting benefits. But sometimes they give anonymously, and much of giving is anonymous. And that is our true puzzle. That is where we see altruism at work. We also know that cooperative societies such as humans have are based on goodwill as well as mere obligation and contract. So altruism is all around us, and yet we can't explain easily how it could have evolved.
How do you define altruism?
Well, from the standpoint of an everyday person who's simply using the word in its normal sense, it means basically being nice to someone else without getting a reward. Technically, it means giving away something that is of interest to your own reproductive success to somebody who is not a close kin person or kinsperson. Because if you invest in your own children, for example, that's not altruism. That's nepotism in common sense parlance. But it's also, technically, it should not hurt your reproductive success. Because if I give a little bit to my children and it helps them a great deal, and we share 50% of our genes, then I'm the beneficiary. My genes are the beneficiary, and the altruistic genes, or in this case, nepotistic genes, we should say, will not be driven out of the gene pool, because someone who invests well in their own children will prosper compared to someone who doesn't.
You write in your book that human beings tend to be driven by ego, nepotism, and altruism in that order. How did you come to that?
Just by sitting and thinking about it, and also by reading quite a bit of theory in evolutionary theory. Darwin himself said that basically individuals are out for themselves as far as their heredity is concerned. They have to be, because the ones who aren't, their heredities are going to dwindle, and the heredities of the the ones who are out for themselves are going to increase. And Darwin himself tackled the problem of altruism. His explanation has held up to a certain degree, but certainly not fully. And his explanation was simply that if you have a group of people who are mostly altruistic, and you have another group who are mostly non-altruistic and selfish, and these two groups get into a fight with each other, which happens with the hunter-gatherers who we look at as evolutionary models, the group of altruists is going to cooperate. And even though their altruism is going to hurt them individually in terms of their genetic success, their group, however, is going to overwhelm the other group. And therefore, altruism could be selected by group selection as opposed to selection at the individual level, which is what we've been talking about up till now.
So an altruistic group of hunter-gatherers, let's say you've got a few hundred people in a band of hunter-gatherers, not of all of whom are, I suppose they're all related. I mean, we have to define what related
means. No, they aren't related. Typical hunting band is composed of multiple families that are not related. So when they cooperate, it is altruistic. And that's why our puzzle is such a big one.
So when they behave in an altruistic manner toward each other, in a hunter-gatherer band, what would that look like?
Well, here's exactly what it looks like. You have a band of, let's say, 25 people, maybe five families, of whom there are a few maybe siblings, but most of the people are totally unrelated. And this band of people, when it comes to getting vegetable foods, they are perfectly happy just to cooperate at the family level, which is explained by nepotism theory. That is, relatives helping each other, parents helping their offspring especially. But when it comes to meat, and I'm talking about large game, which has been a primary food for humans for a quarter of a million years, when it comes to meat, these people share the meat equally throughout the band, even though maybe one or two hunters are killing almost all the meat. So these guys are big altruists. But in a sense, they may be altruists while they're at their prime, but when they become old, then some other big altruist is going to be helping everybody. So to a certain degree, it all levels out. But to another degree, it doesn't. We call it indirect reciprocity. That is, in a hunting band, if you're a very good hunter, you figure, I'm really provisioning half the band right now and doing the lion's share of this. But at some point, someone else is going to take over that role, and I'm going to get some back. Maybe not exactly the amount back that I gave, but at least it's going to help me. And that's the psychology of it. Now, the genetics of it is that the band as a whole is sharing meat, and that there is definitely altruism going on. So we do have that puzzle.
Well, the band is sharing meat, and because everybody has that amount of protein in their diet, the whole band is strong, which presumably is why they are more likely to survive. Is that the logic?
Well, that logic only carries about halfway, because the nature of hunting bands everywhere in the world, there are at least 339 of them that have been studied. Nature of these bands is that they are always porous. That is, people are moving back and forth together from one band to another all the time. Let's say I stay in one band for a while and I'm getting a lot of meat because I'm not a good hunter and another guy is, and then I move to another band and maybe I'm the best hunter there. So you never know what's going on in terms of looking at a single band competing with other bands. It's more like a huge nexus with people cooperating across bands.
We're talking to anthropologist Christopher Bohm.